H. Keith Ralston. John Sullivan Diaz, a black entrepreneur in British Columbia, salmon canning. BC Studies, number 32, winter, 1976 to 1977. Personality and History in British Columbia, essays in honor of Margaret Ormsby. The presence in colonial Vancouver Island and British Columbia of a black community has attracted the attention of several historians as well as a shoal of journalists. Most of the blacks in the two colonies came from San Francisco in an organized migration in 1858, the year of the gold rush to the bars of the lower Fraser River. The exodus was prompted primarily not by the gold excitement, but by fears of a worsening of the discrimination against blacks in the state of California. The position in law of the small black community in pre-Civil War California was by no means a secure one. Although the state constitution of 1849 prohibited slavery, slaves already in the state or brought in by their masters were not automatically free. Anomalies in the Fugitive Slave Law of 1852 seemed in fact to menace the position of blacks already freed. Even more pervasive in their effects were laws of 1851 banning black testimony in civil and criminal cases. The black community agitated with some success against discriminatory legislation, but early in 1858 its campaign appeared to be losing ground as a fresh wave of hostility against blacks mounted. The virtual suspension of action against fugitive slaves ended with the famous Archie Lee case, in which a slave was returned to his master in circumstances of doubtful legality. The year 1858 also saw a revival of attempts to prohibit the immigration of blacks into the state, in a bill which was only with difficulty killed by the adjournment of the legislature. A further blow was the reversal by the San Francisco Board of Education of its decision to admit the daughter of black merchant Peter Lester to an all-white school. A portion of the black community reacted to these threats by organizing a migration out of the state. Choosing, quote-unquote, liberty under the British Lion, as Mifflin W. Gibbs, one of their leaders, later phrased it, and attracted by the Fraser River excitement, they decided on the colony of Vancouver Island, and several hundred moved to Victoria in the spring of 1858, as the rush from California to the new diggings built to a climax. The expectation of liberty under the British Lion was in the main fulfilled. After 10 years, Gibbs himself could still say to black readers in the United States, even though he was shortly to leave British territory, quote, "Upon the great questions of human rights, she is still head and shoulders above you, proclaiming and maintaining from her flagstaffs planted around the world equality before the law. All honor to old England," end quote. The black migrants received official support from Governor James Douglas of Vancouver Island, and the newcomers were welcomed by the Reverend Edward Cridge of the Church of England. As early arrivals, they were able to make advantageous purchases of land, and their labor, especially that of the skilled tradesmen, was in demand. Other blacks followed them, and soon a community was established as an important element in Boomtown, Victoria. Equal before the law, though they may have been, their presence was resented by many whites, and a series of incidents revealing white prejudice followed. Blacks became embroiled in island politics by voting when, as aliens, they were not entitled to. Their presence in various church organizations was resented. A flower-throwing incident occurred in a local theater. Their militia unit, although first in the colony, was derided and snubbed. Unpleasant as they were, these events did not, however, prevent the blacks from sharing in the general prosperity to Vancouver Island from successive gold rushes in the neighboring colony of British Columbia. A grudging acceptance of them developed, although remainders of deep-rooted prejudice continued. An alien act permitted them to become naturalized, and their leader, Mifflin Gibbs, was elected to Victoria City Council by the whites of the fashionable James Bay Ward. After 1865, with the decline of the gold fields, a general exodus took place from British Columbia. For blacks, the added attraction of the end of slavery and of the Civil War in the United States, with its apparent opening of new opportunities, were a magnet to draw them back to the land of their birth. The black presence in British Columbia slowly faded. leaving behind only a relative handful of people, objects now not of prejudice but of curiosity, and unable to sustain the vigorous community life of the 1860s. Although Major J.S. Matthews, F.W. Howey, and Robbie Reed wrote on limited aspects of black history in colonial days, current foundations for scholarly study of the community were laid by James Pilton in an M.A. thesis in history accepted at the University of British Columbia in 1951, and still unfortunately not published. The most recent survey by Professor Robin Winks of Yale University added some new material to Pilton's findings, but did not alter his general emphasis. The work of Pilton and Winks took place against the background of an increasing interest in North American black studies, and was accompanied by a multiplication of journalistic pieces. Most of these latter concentrated on the same picturesque parts of the story: the California difficulties, the opportunities of 1858, the discrimination, the black settlers on Salt Spring Island, and of course, the Victoria Pioneer Rifle Corps. Very few portraits of individual blacks emerged from these efforts, the notable exception being that of Gibbs, already a leader in the California black community, who continued to prosper on Vancouver Island and was elected to public office. But Gibbs himself provided in his autobiography most of the material for an analysis of his long and distinguished career. Lack of a similar source has prevented emergence of other members of the black community as distinct figures. It can be argued in any case that the success story of Gibbs does not begin in British Columbia. He had been established in San Francisco, had capital to invest in Victoria, and had a trade as a carpenter, which served him well in his first days. Therefore, it seems worthwhile to draw at least an outline picture of the fortunes of another black migrant who was not in the same original group of 1858 and who did not start with the same advantages as Gibbs. John Sullivan Diaz was born in South Carolina about 1838, probably in Charleston, which in common with other southern cities of the time had a community of free blacks, many of whom were skilled tradesmen. By 1856, Diaz, still in his teens, was himself advertising as a tinsmith. Sometime thereafter, he joined the migration to Gold Rush, California, and was by 1860 in San Francisco. The young man was, however, not alone in the California metropolis, but lived with a family of South Carolina-born blacks, Lewis and Susan Mortimer. Sharing the same address was another South Carolinian, Z. Diaz. Lewis Mortimer and Zephania W. Diaz are known to have been partners in a produce business in the Niantic Hotel building at the northwest corner of Clay and Sanson Streets. Zephania Diaz, aged 23, was possibly an older brother of John Sullivan, aged 21. Susan Mortimer, aged 22, might have been a sister. During 1860 and 1861, Diaz worked in San Francisco at his trade of tinsmith, being employed for at least part of the time by Martin Prague, a dealer in stoves and tinware. This latter connection most likely led to Diaz's migration to Vancouver Island, where Prague also had an establishment. By 1862, Diaz was established in Victoria in the colony of Vancouver Island. In September of that year, he married Fanny Harris from Hamilton, Canada West. The ceremony was performed by the Reverend Edward Cridge, the then Dean of the Anglican Cathedral, at the home of Richard H. Johnson, an officer in the Black Militia Unit, the Victoria Pioneer Rifle Corps. The wedding was reported in the San Francisco Black newspaper, the Pacific Appeal. Diaz continued to work at his trade during the next few years, and he and his wife began raising the first of a numerous brood of children. By 1866, Diaz was in business for himself in Yale, a transfer point between water and road transportation on the route to the Caribou gold fields. A business in Yale could not have hoped to prosper as the gold fields were declining, but Diaz stuck it out for at least 2 years. By late 1868, however, he was back in Victoria and operating hardware and stove business at the corner of Fort and Broad Streets under the name of Birmingham House. By this time, he also owned property on Upper Yates Street, presumably his residence. As the gold excitement died away after 1865, efforts intensified to find new resources to exploit. The potential of Fraser River salmon was well known, but a first attempt to export the fish in cans was not made until the late 1860s, and it failed through lack of capital. In 1871, Diaz was caught up in a fresh start at developing a salmon canning industry. In that year, two separate canning ventures were launched. One of the entrants to the business was Captain Edward Stamp, a shipmaster and entrepreneur who had already been active as an exporter of spars, a Victoria Commission merchant, and manager of logging and sawmilling enterprises on the Alberni Canal and in Burrard Inlet. Stamp had left the sawmill on Burrard Inlet after a disagreement with his principals and proposed to make a fresh start as a canner of salmon. In June 1871, he leased buildings in the former Royal Engineers Camp near New Westminster, which he proceeded to adapt for the purpose. The cans for such a process had at that time to be made virtually by hand, and Stamp engaged Diaz to make his cans. During that season's salmon runs, Stamp's cannery produced on a modest scale, but with enough success to encourage him to continue. He undertook a trip to England to raise capital for a large-scale canning enterprise, and while there died of a heart attack. Diaz continued in canning in 1872 in the aftermath of Stamp's death. Finlay, Durham, and Brody, merchants in Victoria, were involved in the Stamp venture. It's not clear whether they simply act as agents for shipping to England by the Princess Royal of the salmon canned by Stamp, or whether they purchased the completed product from Stamp and shipped it on their own account. In any case, according to Mr. Justice H.P.P. Creese, who was keenly interested in analyzing new business opportunities, Finlay, Durham, and Brody ended up by taking over Stamp's business to save themselves, and in the fishing season of 1872, went ahead filling up the rest of the cans that had been made for Stamp. The scanty information on the 1872 season is confusing. Evidence from Creese is that Finlay, Durham, and Brody carried on their salvage operations in the Royal Engineers Camp, at least the season before by Stamp. But Creese also says that they set up Diaz that contracted for making Stamp's tin cans. Other evidence indicates that Diaz's operations in 1872 were not at New Westminster but some miles downstream at Cooperville, on the south bank of the main channel just opposite the head of what is now known as Diaz Island. This choice of location seems to have been prompted by the availability of a suitable building built in 1870 for Captain James Cooper for a short-lived venture in salting and barreling salmon. Whether this means that there were two separate operations or that Diaz was in charge of both cannot be said with certainty. Nothing is known about the success of the first season of operations at Cooperville, but encouraged Diaz and his backers to expand. There was an immediate problem. Access to the Cooperville site was only by water, and the approach for steamers was not easy, likely because of the characteristically shelving banks and marshy edges of the Fraser River Delta. The main channel, however, with its deep water, curved along the outer edge of the nearby island. It has in the succeeding 100 years steadily eroded the head of the island. In April 1873, Diaz preempted on the island, which now bears his name, and there proceeded to erect a cannery which was likely ready to operate in the season of 1873. His contemporary statements about the scale of his operations in 1873 and 1874 tend to confirm this, and later accounts date the foundation of the cannery to 1873. In any case, before the 1874 season, about 7 acres had been diked on the north end of the low-lying marshy island, and a complex of buildings had been built. Two large structures housed the cannery in its associated warehousing space, and a third was a dwelling house, possibly a bunkhouse. There were also a number of smaller buildings. Since fish collection, as well as shipping the product, depended on the river frontage, the whole was completed by a substantial wharf. Diaz was, of course, unlikely to have financed this rapid expansion from his own resources. The key to his obtaining the necessary backing lies in his relations with Finlay, Durham, and Brody. The practice in the Pacific Coast canning industry at the time was for commission merchants to handle the export of the product, which in British Columbia was virtually all shipped abroad, chiefly to England. The canner received his money on shipment from the merchant, who has discounted the bill of lading, holding it and collecting the face value when the cargo was delivered to the consignee. In addition to acting as agents, these firms also often provided financial advances to carry cannery operations through the long cycle from ordering Welsh tinplate to completion of the season's pack. Those advances were usually secured against the chattel mortgage. Probably Diaz's financing was arranged in this way, although no such document is known in his case. Still, there's little doubt that Diaz himself was, within these limitations, common to many businesses, the actual owner of the cannery. He acquired the land through preemption, and the improvements were in his name. The canned salmon produced by the plant was also marketed in Diaz's name, if we accept the evidence of a gaily colored salmon label, the earliest of its kind to survive from the British Columbia industry, bearing the legend Fresh Salmon John S. Diaz, Fraser River, British Columbia. This label was lithographed for Diaz by G.T. Brown & Co. of San Francisco, a firm owned by California black artist Grafton T. Brown. Diaz had an early start in what was to become in the 1870s a thriving business. Stamps Cannery had been one of two operating in 1871. The other firm, a partnership between fisherman Alexander Ewan and James Wise, and New Brunswick canner Alexander Logie and tinsmith David Hennessy, had started operations at a site opposite and slightly below New Westminster, later known as Annieville. The building there had originally been put up in 1864 as a saltery, and was subsequently used in 1867 and 1868 by James Sim for the first attempt at commercial canning in British Columbia. These pioneer canners had to contend with marked annual fluctuations in the abundance of salmon on the Fraser River. A pronounced four-year cycle characterized the races of sockeye salmon, the species favored by the early canners. In those years, the dominant ran on the pattern 1869, 1873, 1877, with a subdominant year following each heavy year and two light years in between. Yet in the earliest years, the difficulty of mastering the canning process itself rather than the abundance of fish determined the size of the pack. According to Diaz, in 1872, a light year, the runs were so small that the 300,000 cans, 6,250 cases, prepared for the pack could not be filled. But even in 1873, a heavy year when good packs might be expected, both Diaz and Logie and Company, as the partnership was commonly called, could together put up only a little more than 4,250 cases. Canning as a process, however, became sufficiently established to attract additional capital to the industry. Not only the example of the Fraser River, but the soaring packs on the nearby Columbia River, which by the early 1870s reached the order of 200,000 to 250,000 cases, inspired would-be canners. By 1874, New Westminster merchants Henry Holbrook and James Cunningham had leased and reopened the former Royal Engineer premises used by Stamp. They were joined by a British incorporated firm, the Vancouver Island Company, put together by Gilbert Malcolm Sproat, then Agent General for British Columbia in London, which had a cannery building constructed at Brownsville opposite New Westminster. This latter firm seems to have lasted only one season. Throughout these early years of development, Diaz was the leading canner on the Fraser River. For the seasons 1872 and 1873, he could boast that he had canned twice as large a pack as any other fishery. The published figures for 1874 and 1876 show him maintaining his lead, and the 1875 figures, though not available, would no doubt confirm the trend. But as the big cycle year of 1877 approached, this lead was threatened. A firm market and anticipation of heavy catches produced a minor boom. The partnership known as Logie & Company had in 1875 been reorganized, as Ewan and Wise, with the withdrawal and subsequent death of Logie. During the winter of 1876 to 1877, Ewan and Wise built a new cannery on Front Street in New Westminster. Two new firms also prepared for the coming season. A partnership headed by Marshall M. English set up in buildings constructed by New Westminster merchant Ebenezer Brown, MLA, on his property at Brownsville, across the river from the city. James Finlayson and Colonel C.C. Lane adapted a collection of buildings on the New Westminster waterfront for a cannery. Diaz must have watched the opening of additional canneries with some uneasiness. He was already on record in his first years as a canner as having a limited view of the potential of the Fraser River. There were, he said in 1874, not three good drifts on the river. Already fishermen were having to wait for half a day for their turn on overcrowded drifts. The Fraser River, he argued, ought not to be compared to the Columbia. For on the last named, the season and run are twice as long, and the drifts extend for miles, whereas on this river the run is short and irregular. If Diaz had premonitions of more intense competition from extra fishermen and boats, they were realized early in the season of 1877. The New Westminster canneries, led by English and Company, ranged up and down the river seeking fish. English and Company operated from the mouth of the river to Langley, above New Westminster, and at various times during the season brought fish by steamer from as far away as Harrison River, and Yale even used wagons to transport the catch from Mud Bay. The fishermen of Finlayson and Lane followed them, using a dwelling on floats that could be moved from place to place. Holbrook and Company had stations both above and below New Westminster. But it was with the fishermen of the remaining New Westminster cannery, Ewan and Wise, that Diaz clashed most spectacularly. At the height of the season, a complaint laid by Ewan and Wise before two New Westminster justices of the peace charged Diaz with using violent and threatening language to their fishermen. The charges were laid when Diaz attempted to prevent encroachment on a drift near his cannery that he had especially cleared of snags. Diaz, not present at the hearing, was sentenced to 3 weeks in prison and brought up to New Westminster in custody. He was admitted to bail, however, and the case was later thrown out on appeal to County Court Judge Peter O'Reilly. The local newspaper attacked the justices of the peace and maintained editorially that the whole incident was a stratagem by the accusers to disrupt production of a rival company by embroiling its superintendent in a time-wasting dispute in the busiest part of the season. Whatever troubles Diaz had in the season of 1877, and his pack dropped from first to third place behind English and Company, who packed 24,000 cases to his 11,000, and Finlayson and Lane, who were slightly ahead at 12,000, more was yet to come. Three more canneries were planned for the coming season of 1878, and, the worst blow, one was to be erected at Ladner's Landing, not 2 miles below Diaz's plant. This last provoked him to a final effort to protect his stretch of the river. He applied to A.C. Anderson, Inspector of Fisheries for the Federal Department of Marine and Fisheries, for an exclusive lease of drifts near his cannery. The application provoked opposition in both the provincial legislature and the Senate in Ottawa. In Victoria, the House passed unanimously a motion moved by W.J. Armstrong, member for the New Westminster District, and seconded by E. Brown, New Westminster City member, calling on the federal government to refuse to grant any exclusive right to fish for salmon in the waters of British Columbia, and alleging it would be, quote, a great injustice to the fishing interest, end quote, with which interest the worthy seconder was, as we have seen, deeply involved. In Ottawa, three British Columbia senators spoke against the application. The result of this weighty opposition, echoed in the press, was that the proposal was effectively dead. After this defeat, Diaz was to remain only one more season in the canning business. And indeed, there is evidence that he planned to leave even before his application for release was rejected. In November 1877, his wife, Fanny, bought in her own name a rooming house in Portland, Oregon, for which she paid $2,700 in U.S. gold coins. Perhaps other factors were at work in addition to Diaz's pessimism about the future of Fraser River canning. In a dispute over school taxes in the summer of 1877, he's alleged to have said he would pay only if the money were returned for a teacher and a school on Diaz Island. Maybe he and his wife were worried about educational opportunities for their growing family. Their elder children were into their teens. Possibly his health was beginning to fail. Tinsmithing was a notoriously unhealthy trade, and the rooming house looks like an attempt to provide his wife with an income. It could be that it was the start of a move to what he saw as the better opportunities on the Columbia River. The prologue to the season of 1878 could only serve to confirm in Diaz a gloomy view of the future of the Fraser River industry. The boom in canneries and disputes between fishermen, as well as alleged waste of fish and the use of low-quality raw fish transported from upper reaches of the river, all combined to decide the Federal Department of Marine and Fisheries to impose a set of regulations on the previously unrestricted operation of the canneries. A wrangle followed between the Ottawa authorities and the canners, with the latter generally maintaining that the Fisheries Act could not be applied to British Columbia conditions, and specifically opposing regulations designed to prevent disputes between fishermen, such as the one involving Diaz in the previous season. They also opposed a 48-hour weekly closed time included in the proposed federal regulations. Although canners were successful in modifying the orders, any restriction was seen by them and their supporters as an unwarranted intrusion into the affairs of the industry. The season of 1878 saw a continuation of the boom of 1877. 8 canneries operated on the Fraser River, and the pack of the river rose from 65,000 to 105,000 cases, even though in the subdominant year fish were not so abundant. The pack of the Diaz Island cannery was the smallest of all, but then Diaz waited only until the peak of the season was over before making his move to withdraw. On 19th of August 1878, he announced he had sold all right, title, and interest in the fishery on Diaz Island, Fraser River, to Messrs. Finley, Durham, and Brodie, and my connection with the same ceases from this date. The publication of this notice in the local newspaper followed another, asking that claims against Diaz be sent to him care of the new owners in Victoria. It is not possible to give an exact value for the interest that Diaz sold to Finley, Durham, and Brodie. The price he received is not known, and the registration of the sale of the island lists only a nominal figure for the transaction. In the next year, 1879, however, the valuation of the cannery for tax purposes was $10,000 for the plant and $3,000 for the land. This compares closely with an estimate of $15,000 for the worth of the Diaz Island operation made in 1881 by the Inspector of Fisheries as part of an evaluation of all canneries. It was the lowest amount for any Fraser River cannery, and coupled with a report that year that it was the only one still cooking its cans in boiling water, rather than using the newer steam retort, it indicates that machinery and equipment had not been updated, all of which suggests an old-fashioned plant needing considerable expenditure, yet another reason for selling. In any case, the financial settlement required by the sale would have been complicated, involving not only the payments of outstanding accounts, but also of advances for the 1878 season and receipts from the season's pack. So while Diaz's family left British Columbia almost immediately, he himself traveled back to New Westminster a number of times between August and the end of the year. Tragedy was soon to strike the Diaz family in their new home in Portland. On the 22nd of July 1880, less than 2 years after he sold his cannery, John Sullivan Diaz died, aged only 42 years. The cause of death is not recorded, but indications are that he had been ill for some time. Besides his widow, Fanny, he left a family of 7 children, the eldest being 16 years old and the youngest 4 years old. 7 seasons in salmon canning in the first decade of continuous operations on the Fraser River entitled John Sullivan Diaz to a prominent place among the founders of the canning industry in British Columbia. His 15 or so years in Vancouver Island, British Columbia, were indeed marked by substantial material prosperity. In addition to owning several businesses, he acquired property by purchase and Crown Grant, some of it considerable in value. He became a citizen of his adopted land and a provincial voter. He seems to have been well liked by his contemporaries, including those who worked for him. Diaz's career is a typical immigrant success story. What is difficult to estimate is what influence his being black had upon it. He would today be completely forgotten except that a major highway crosses the Fraser River onto the island bearing his name. But other early salmon canners whose careers were even more distinguished than that of Diaz are also forgotten. Some indication, however, of the problem of being black may be seen in, admittedly isolated, contemporary attitudes to him. While saying he is well-liked and defending him in the fighting between fishermen in 1877, the New Westminster newspaper implies that he is only manager of the cannery, not the owner. Other instances of people regarding Finley, Durham, and Brodie's as the real owner, and not just Diaz's agents, also occur. It was just too difficult to believe that a black could be a major entrepreneur in an industry whose success was so devoutly wished for. The social attitudes to blacks are also prominent in an episode involving Diaz and his family, the quote-unquote haunting of a house into which they had just moved. The stereotype about blacks and fear of ghosts, and the readiness to see blacks as an object of merriment and even derision, both come through in reports of the incident in the leading newspaper of Victoria, The Colonist. The position of blacks in Vancouver Island, British Columbia, in the 1860s and 70s, as the case of Diaz exemplifies, was clearly better than that of the Chinese, the largest of non-white immigrants. Blacks were behaviorally assimilated to the white community and were therefore not perceived to be as alien as their Asian counterparts. No anti-black laws prevented them from using their talents to prosper, but the potential for discrimination was nevertheless there and was manifested on a number of occasions in the early 1860s. Social pressure against them diminished only as their numbers dwindled after 1865. The fading of the community memory about unpleasant incidents involving blacks should not, however, allow present-day British Columbians to look back in a complacent belief that the treatment of this minority differed in kind, rather than just in intensity, from that given other non-white groups.